Hey, what is going on, everyone? It's me, Mr. Mario, and welcome back to another episode of Mod Chat. For those who do not know, this is a podcast I do here in two different forms. First of all, it is available in a video visual form here on the Mr. Mario 2011 YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey channels. Secondly, it is available like an actual podcast in an audio-only form. Simply look up Mod Chat, all one word, in your favorite podcasting app, host, provider, or platform, and you should hopefully be able to find it. I know it's not available on all of them, but it is available on most of them. Either way, this is a show where I come on here and talk to you about new things that I find interesting, cool, do a little bit of show and tell, all in the realm of video game modding and video game console modding. Now, I try and do this at least once a month, and while as this is not typically a news show, I guess some people do consume it as such, and it doesn't really matter how you consume it as long as you enjoy it. That's the most important part here. Either way, we do have a wide variety of topics here for different systems that we're going to be getting into. So let's go ahead and just jump right into the topics. I guess Lily's going to sleep there and be okay with it, but let's just jump to these topics. So for the first piece of homebrew here we're covering, it is a PS4 release that ended up happening last month, but it was neat enough that I did want to throw it on here. This is PS4 Player 3D, and the initial release was from Lappy. Now, this is someone who has been quite essential in the PS4 homebrew scene, where he's made several games, utilities, and such for the PlayStation 4, but this here is a video player with 3D support, with optional PS4 VR support as well too, so a pretty unique tool here that I really haven't seen, and it's cool that we got it here even as late as 2024. Looking at this Wololo article, it states here, PS4 scene developer Lappy has released a new piece of homebrew. PS4 Player 3D is an MP4 video player with support for 3D videos. This is a first release, of course, so it comes with limitations. It only supports MP4 files for now, for example, but this is a very promising tool, and I'm hoping we'll see some updates down the line. Now, what is PS4 Player 3D? It is a homebrew application for the PS4 that lets you play 3D movie files, currently supporting the MP4 format. It leverages PSVR, but this is not a requirement for immersive 3D support. So, covering some of this, it does state that it is a 3D player with VR support, although the PSVR is not required. You can copy your 3D videos to a folder named 3D Videos on a USB drive or in the /data directory on the internal drive, and the app can automatically configure playback if you add one of the strings to the video file name. So you're essentially setting flags right here, similar to an executable, except you're doing this all on video file names. So 180 for 180 degree videos, 360 for 360 degree videos, TB for top bottom videos, LR for left right videos, and it looks like there's some other flags for EQU, CUB, and EAC. So there we go, something that I certainly think is awesome here and a tool that I do love to see. Now, in regards to this, it does kind of have a little bit of a throwback to the days of when 3D was definitely the big rage in terms of like what's next with TVs and such on here. So I think for people who are watching like actual 3D videos, it's going to be a little limiting there since really not many new displays support 3D. However, I think this is going to be huge for people who have PSVR support and a jailbroken PlayStation so they can get some more usage out of it. We're going back to the original Xbox here with a tool that I'm going to be covering a bit more in depth here in a dedicated video. However, we're going to be covering here XCAT, which is the Xbox Content Archive tool, which was recently released as well in March. Now, from Go Team Scotch over on Xbox Scene, they state that Xbox preservationists have been hard at work developing XCAT, an automated tool to allow Xbox owners to search their consoles for lost Xbox content and have it be uploaded as a part of a collaborative effort to archive DLC, title updates, homebrew content, apps, skins, etc., and more. Using this tool, the community can pool their efforts to archive lost Xbox content that may be lingering out in the wild on consoles and preserve it for the benefit of everyone. As of today, March 25th, 2024, the team behind this powerful tool have released version 1.0 to the public. And to quote it here, XCAT is a utility that runs directly on an Xbox console to assist in finding unarchived DLC and other lost content. When run, the application will scan the Xbox hard drive for any content that has yet to be archived and upload it directly to the servers of the XCAT team for later analysis, sorting, and archival. The XCAT team is looking for more than DLC, homebrew dashboard skins, Xbox Live Message of the Day files, long-lost game mod packs. A lot of community-made content is now lost to time. but there is a chance it could be found. This 1.0 release includes a standard XBE compatible with soft-modded and hard-modded Xbox consoles. In addition to this, the team has also bundled a variation that is compatible with in-game, the new soft-mod method requiring only a memory unit or a USB drive. This utility is just 3.7 megabytes, meaning it can fit onto a memory unit alongside in-game. This is especially useful for users who may not be interested in modding their console, but still wish to contribute potentially lost content on their Xbox to the XCAT project for preservation. And really, it goes down, and when you run it, it will scan your C drive, your E drive, the F drive for apps and games, G drive for apps and games, and the XYZ partitions for cache. When run, it calculates a unique checksum for each file found. A list of checksums is then sent to the XCAT servers for analysis. If any individual file is determined to be new and not yet archived, it is then put into a queue and uploaded right from the user's console. If a file is already present on XCAT servers, that file will not be uploaded again. This method also avoids duplicates caused by differing naming schemes, as each individual file is hashed. Now, they say that the XCAT team has also made great efforts to gather checksums for existing known files, such as redump CCI game sets and known homebrew, to avoid these being uploaded. As more people use this tool over time, more checksums will be gathered, meaning each individual person is less likely to have a large amount of content that needs to be uploaded. Now, the goal for this is collecting lost content is just one step in the preservation process. The next step here is to share any relevant lost content with the community as a whole. This will happen in a variety of ways. Recovered content that is useful or relevant for playing games on Insignia, the modern replacement for Xbox Live, will be shared with the Insignia team. It may be made available as updates from within said game. Other content such as lost homebrew apps, games, skins, etc. will be made available in the relevant channels, which is to be determined. Now, there is a hot list of content right here, which we can go ahead and check out. So this is going to be the console mods wiki for unarchived DLC. So this is really what they are after here. And some of the examples are, well, if we look at higher priority, these games are known to have missing DLC or updates that would benefit the Xbox community immediately. So how about this for Halo 2? They're looking for 22 title updates. However, it'd be number 5, like title update number 5 for Spain, Korea, Japan, 19 miscellaneous older title updates. Mech Assault, it looks like there's also title updates as well too, like for Southeast Asia or Japan. For Phantasy Star Online, it looks like there's two pieces of DLC. So this would be the Central Dome Fire Swirl in French and Spanish. These ones are recreated by fans. And then if we look at some of the lower priority ones, like Brute Force, for example, DLC, there's three pieces, Copy from Another Region / Language, Doom 3, four pieces of DLC from other regions. So this is just showing what's here. And then there's some unknown games as well too that might have some DLC. So they show right here what it looks like if you have DLC that has not been archived, or you just have DLC in general on your Xbox. And you can use something such as Pinecone, which we've covered here, to dump and archive that. However, let's say you're someone who you have a few Xboxes that were on Xbox Live back in the day. You really haven't used them. You don't want to feel like modding them or anything. You could really just use a adapter and a USB drive, and now you can use XCAT at this time. And it says right here, contributing content with the Xbox content archiving tool. And it's quite literally as easy as opening up XCAT, hitting A a few times, and then just letting it churn through, sit there, and upload any content to the XCAT servers. So it's been made incredibly easy, and thankfully the XCAT team is made up of some pretty awesome people, so they have been able to prove themselves over time to be reputable, trustworthy, and getting that lost content back out there where it needs to be. Now, here's something that was pretty cool that we ended up covering at one point a few months ago, but it's finally been released. This is Halo 2 HD. Now, yes, we've had Halo 2 HD. We've had it on, you know, Vista. We've had it, of course, on the Master Chief Collection. If you want to count it, playing on 360 backwards compatibility. But no, this is an actual HD mod for the original Halo 2 on the original Xbox from Grim Doomer. And looking at it here, it states that Halo 2 HD is a mod for the original Xbox version of Halo 2 to add support for HD resolutions as well as some quality of life updates. This mod will let you play the game in 480p proper, 720p and 1080i, although that is 1080p internally, which is pretty awesome to see. The features it states here are 480p proper, 720p and 1080i resolutions, although it's 1080p internally there, triple buffering support to increase frame rate performance, utilizes extra RAM if you have 128MB RAM upgrade, GPU overclocking for performance improvements, increased hard drive transfer speed for faster load times, customizable field of view, customizable split screen divider, horizontal or vertical. That one is nice. That one is a nice one there. If you've ever done something like, for example, if you've played split screen Halo 2 and you had widescreen mode enabled, it is really annoying having that vertical setup right there. The horizontal one is nicer. And those are all customizable features through an anyconfig file, which there is a big detail about it here on the wiki itself. Now, some people might be wondering what's going on with the 480p proper. And he states here that Halo 2 claims it supports 480p on the box, but this isn't entirely accurate. It does support 480p output, but it does not render in 480p natively. Regardless of what video settings are set on the console, the stock game will always render in 640x480. When 480p output is enabled, the console will upscale the final 640x480 image to 480p for display on TV. If you enable widescreen mode, the game will apply anamorphic scaling to the image, which causes it to appear compressed width-wise. This patch addresses those issues by rendering in proper 480p resolution and disabling the anamorphic scaling that would normally get applied. It also allows you to play the game in 720p or 1080i. When 1080i mode is enabled, the game is actually rendering at 1080p internally before being encoded into interlaced video signal. The 1080i mode is not considered playable, as it puts an extreme load on the console GPU even when overclocking, and typically plays at single digit frames per second at best. I added support for it mostly because I want to see if I can get it to work, and also so I could take some sweet screenshots before the frame buffer gets converted into interlaced video. And you have it right here as an example where it shows essentially the original 640x480 image, and then 720x480, so proper 480p, a 720p image, and then a 1080p image, which that's really awesome to see. And indeed, as it shows right here, this will make for really awesome screenshots pulled out of the original Xbox, but certainly wouldn't be playable at that high of a resolution on such an old system. Now, this is one thing that I want to mention, and I'm probably going to have some footage that's playing on here, and the footage you're going to see is actually the game running in 480p mode. I do want to show a bit of an experience that most people I feel like will have, because this is important here. In terms of RAM upgrades, it states if your console has 128MB of RAM, this patch will utilize the extra RAM available, which will enable use of 720p and 1080i video modes, as well as increase the size of in-memory caches for textures and geometry. The size increase for the texture and geometry caches will significantly reduce pop-in issues to the point of being almost non-existent. So for anybody who goes and applies this patch and installs it on their system and they don't notice a huge difference, that's more than likely because you probably have a stock, I guess, RAM Xbox, meaning that your Xbox has 64MB of RAM. So even if you go in and enable 720p and 1080i, unless you have upgraded the RAM, you will not be able to utilize those high resolutions, unfortunately. He also mentions that GPU overclocking is available. However, there are many risks and precautions you'll want to take on that. You can also increase your hard drive transfer speeds, which is nice, and you can do that from the any file. However, do keep in mind that you are going to have to do some more physical modifications on that. Like, for example, if you need transfer speeds faster than UDMA 3, you're going to need an 80-pin IDE cable. For UDMA 4 or 5 with the stock 40-pin cable, you'll get some read errors and game crashing on startup. However, it's more noted here for the hard drive transfer speeds. This would be a setting that you should more so tweak only if you're on a BIOS that doesn't have those increased speeds. So if you haven't applied Titan patch or if you're not using SirBIOS. Some people are probably going to ask about this here, but in terms of compatibility, he states due to how this patch works, it is not compatible with the Xbox 360 backcompat emulator, nor will it ever be. It would require complex changes to the emulator itself, and I have no plans on ever investigating it further. This patch is also not been tested on XQEMU or any other emulator for PC. It has only been tested on real hardware, and I have no plans for providing additional support for any other means of running original Xbox games. So just keep that in mind. The intention of this is just going to be on completely bare metal original Xbox hardware, not a PC emulator, not the 360 emulator for it. You can run this on a stock Xbox, or you can run it on a tricked out Xbox with the highest modifications and compatibilities possible on there. Really just the best best upgrades you can do, but don't bank on being able to play this on the 360 backwards compatible emulator. Now, currently there are a few issues and limitations, one of them being that this currently only works with the 1.0 version of the game and not the 1.5 version. However, he does plan to port this to the 1.5 update at one point in the future. Some of the other issues here state that campaign checkpoints may not work between this patch and other versions of the game. When loading a campaign save, you may have to start the most recent level from the beginning instead of from the last checkpoint. You'll not be able to take screenshots using Xbox Neighborhood or any other tools when running with 128 megabytes of RAM. HUD elements will get smaller when using high resolutions. Bink videos will still play at 640 by 480 resolution. Campaign loading screen, player sign screen, and pre-game lobbies still render in 640 by 480. Adjusting this is non-trivial and most likely won't be fixed. So you can probably see that in some of the video footage here. However, overall, this is a really cool patch that has been made for the original Xbox and for Halo 2. And I'll say this, for anybody who is curious, it would be worth checking out. You can go to the releases here, download the zip file, and it really just comes down to applying a X Delta patch to a clean version of Halo 2, so the original Halo 2 1.0 XBE, and then transfer over the accompanying .ini file, which you can come over to the configuration file wiki right here, and it breaks down everything in regards to the settings and such on here, which you can enable and disable. For what it's worth, the footage that I am showing you all is on a hard modded Xbox. However, it has a stock CPU, stock GPU, 64 megabytes of RAM, and it is running in proper 480p when doing recording of all of this. On top of that, I just ended up using the default configuration file. I looked through it and I didn't see anything that I really needed to tweak on my specific setup, so therefore I just transferred it over. So I'm just using it completely stock bare bones in a setup that probably most people who have original modified Xboxes would use. So I did want to cover this here real quick, and I've actually been meaning to cover this in the last couple episodes, but it's so minor that I've actually kept forgetting to do it here. Now, I've talked about the MIG switch a little bit on the channel, which, in case you do not know, is a flash cartridge for the Nintendo Switch. It works on all firmwares. It works on all hardware revisions. It does not need any other modifications or any other custom firmwares. You quite literally just have to dump your games accordingly as per their standard, put them on a micro SD card, and you can pop it into the Switch itself. However, I did a full episode of Mod Chat covering this in December, even before there was a lot of detail about the MIG switch, because I wanted to put it out there and essentially say that on a technical level, I think it's cool, but I think people are really going to be wishing and wanting for a lot more, and this is going to be incredibly limiting for what it is. You're really only going to be able to play stock cartridge dumps, and that's it. And so many months removed now, we do know that for sure. You cannot make your own XCI files. You cannot do NSP to XCI conversions. You can't do any of that stuff. You cannot package in DLC or updates, even if you legally own them. You can really only play stock, like completely stock cartridge dumps on your system. That's really all you can do. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is because there's been, you know, a few small updates here, like some firmware updates here and there. The MIG dump tool was released to make it a little easier. However, when it comes down to it, I have had several people ask, hey, can you cover the MIG switch? Can you cover the MIG switch? Can you cover updates? What new updates are there? And this is me saying here, I mean, the last time I covered this was in December. We're out here in April. I really haven't covered anything because aside from, you know, a few firmware updates, a few bug fixes, and again, the MIG dump tool for custom firmware systems, which allows you to, I mean, dump your cartridges a little bit easier on there. The reason why I really haven't covered this here is because there's not all too much to cover, which is really what I anticipated, because I feel like, again, people are wanting a lot more from the MIG switch, and it's certainly not going to be possible. So what I'm saying is, just like what I said in December, if people are wanting a menu system, if people are wanting something a bit more on there, if people are even wanting a possibility of using a in-game entry point as an exploit onto the system itself, none of that is going to happen, especially even any type of customizations like having a menu system to be able to select your games and load them up that way. The only way I really see that possibly happening is going to be if you can do that on custom firmware. But again, this is all to say here, the MIG switch has been making its way to distributors. The dumper is going to start making its way out. But aside from that, there's really not going to be any major updates in functionality, and there's really nothing else to report on here. So if this is the last last time I really report about anything on the Meg Switch, I wouldn't be too surprised. And this is more me coming out and just spending a few minutes saying there's nothing really here. But while there might not be news in regards to the Meg Switch, there is something else that has started to take a bit more fruition here, which is the Unlock Switch. Now, so far they do have a website, but they're mostly active on their Twitter, and they state here that Unlock Switch is a third-party backup and development device for the Nintendo Switch, not endorsed or licensed by Nintendo. Of course, we're familiar with that. But you can see right here that unlike the Meg Switch, where from what I've been seeing, it's been retailing for about $60-65 US, they're saying here that the recommended retail price for the Unlock Switch is going to be $39 US. So you're going to save a little more money right there. It looks like they're a little more transparent about, you know, what they're showing and such. Like, this is the actual device itself here, although they end up just silk screening over the chips, which have already been known on this. It is going to come with this case here, which is nice. They've been warning people to stay away from scammers and such on here. But at the end of the day, this here, the Unlock Switch, is even, I mean, really, they've claimed this here is a clone of the Meg Switch. However, the reason why this has been interesting is because they've claimed that even though this is a clone, this is going to offer improvements. So they're stating that this is a clone, but it's going to be better than the Meg Switch itself. So far, we really need to see what exact improvements are going to be available on here, because we've seen like some demonstration videos which seem to work about the same, or maybe even, in all honesty, the game switching seems to be a little worse. Although they have tried to answer that things are going to be improved, they also had a few hints at other things such as a button or a physical switch on the Unlock Switch itself, so that you don't have to keep inserting and reinserting the cartridge in order to change games. However, aside from that, what we know for sure at this point is this is a cheaper clone unit of the Meg Switch, and that's all we know. It hasn't gotten out to resellers, it hasn't gotten out to reviewers at the time I'm recording this here, so we just have to wait on this. But that's about the only other update I really have here. It's a different product, but it's a clone of the original product, which many people saw this coming. So I am glad I waited a bit here, because NickMoses05, friend of the show, but also someone who has done a lot of coverage in regards to Team Executor especially, and with some of the other Switch products out there, ended up getting a Unlock Switch for review. He ended up showcasing it on a stream, did a review of it, showcased several of the features, and in short, the piece that he has right now, the very early version that's been sent out to reviewers, I believe 50 copies were sent out for review samples, but it works exactly like the Meg Switch. However, it looks like after the show, Meg Switch themselves, not Unlock Switch, Meg Switch themselves actually ended up reaching out and asked them to run a firmware update, which according to Meg Switch, they got the results back, and in short, they allege that they have proof now after running that and getting the results of it that the Unlock Switch is actually just the Meg Switch itself. It's just a rebranded version, and they claim that ICs were taken off of working Meg Switch units, put onto Unlock Switch PCBs, and they're being sold like this. There's just enough of them out there to get into the hands of reviewers, so reviewers can verify that they do have a sample and that is working. So some people might be asking, what is the deal? Why would a company allegedly do this here? Well, it is believed, at least according to allegations from Meg Switch based off of this here, that this company, Unlock Switch, is just putting out enough samples to show they have a working product. From there, they would be taking in money and taking in orders so that they can actually sell this product, but because there is not an actual product that they're going to be selling here outside of maybe the 50 sample cartridges that they've made, then they can do an exit scam at that point. Again, that is what could be believed right now. That is the allegation, and really time is going to tell what will happen. We'll just really have to monitor this for the next few months here, but that's all to say that this has at least been good information to have on hand, and if anybody would be wanting to pick up one of these here, I'm probably going to say wait on this a little bit. Wait and just see what happens. Now, in the world of PSP, we have some pretty big news here, because we've seen some samples and some teases within the last year. However, we have a new development, which is a word that I didn't even know existed before, so I had to look it up, and I believe this is how best we can say it here, but if I mispronounce it, do forgive me, Azerai. It seems to be a universal unbreaker for every single model of the PSP. Now, some people might be asking, wait, didn't we already have that? Well, not necessarily. Let's just go ahead and get into this Wolo article here. This is from The Zet, and he stated here that PSP hacking scene veteran and developer Davey has finally released Azerai. a universal PSP Unbreaker that supports every PSP model. If used alongside a Baryon Sweeper, Azurai can unbrick any PSP and fully restore it to System Software 6.61, which that is the latest one. Azurai, although they say it is pronounced Asherai, so I guess either of them could be interchangeable. When I was looking it up, Azurai was what I was getting, but either way is a word from the Scots Gaelic language and means resurrection, so it fits right in with older Pandora and unbrick tools such as Desiptar del Cementerio. Now, the requirements for using Azurai do require a memory stick for your PSP or a memory stick micro for the PSP Go, a memory stick Pro Duo for other models, the Azurai IPL file, the 6.61 firmware file for regular PSPs or for the PSP Go, respective of whichever device you're using, and a way of entering service mode on the PSP, which would be a Baryon Sweeper. And that's what it is here. Now, I've talked about Baryon Sweeper several times here on the podcast, and over the last several years, we've seen many updates to Baryon Sweeper, which again is capable of putting, at this point now, it can put any PSP into service mode. However, do keep in mind the actual functionality of fully unbricking any PSP model out there, any of them, has not been possible, to my understanding here, at least in the public, until Azurai has released. Now, do keep in mind that even once you have all of that, there are, it states here, three separate types of Baryon Sweepers. So one for each of the different methods of entering a PSP service mode. Be sure to get the correct one for your model. And this is where it differs here. So if you have a PSP 1, 2, or 3000, you can just use a battery, although you're going to have to build a Baryon Sweeper battery. If you have a PSP E1000, so that's going to be the final model of the PSP, the one that was only released really outside of the US and it was more of the budget-friendly model, you're going to need a mini USB interface. And if you have a PSP Go, you're going to have a Go connector or Go connector interface. And I'm saying that here because with the way Baryon Sweeper works, you are going to have to do a little bit of modifying in order to get any of these working. So that's all to say here, for example, if you're just saying, oh, all I need is a mini USB cable, no, you're going to need more than that. You are going to have to modify in a certain way, just like with the Go connector for the PSP Go. Now, as for final words, they state here that Davies Azurai Unbricker is one of the last few frontiers of PSP hacking has finally been covered. Gone are the days of accidentally turning your PSP into a permanent paperweight, and alongside Infinity 2, Davies' previous release, you can also enjoy custom firmwares without the hassle of manually booting into them, which that's the last big one I've really covered in depth was Infinity 2, which that at least allows you to have a permanent custom firmware on every single model of the PSP. Now, it's fitting that Infinity 2 was just mentioned here, because Infinity 2 now actually has a successor to it with more development here, because there's now a new CIPL, as well as a new release of Desiptar del Cementerio, which is version 10, for every single PSP. So in short, even before the days of Infinity, essentially, you'd be able to flash earlier models of the PSP with a CIPL. And that would allow you to run a custom firmware permanently on cold boot every single time. It worked on the 1000 and it worked for early runs of the 2000. But later models did require you to launch the custom firmware every single time, so it was more of a tethered jailbreak. Infinity did help out with that quite a bit, but it was not in the form of a CIPL. However, now we're back to that point where you can now flash a CIPL to every single model of the PSP. And it even says right here, we're proud to announce that a new CIPL, so Custom IPL and Desiptar del Cementerio, are now available for every single one of the 8 different PSP models, thanks to Davies' vastly improved and updated IPL SDK, and also Balika's previous CIPL and DC9 code for 03G devices, it was possible to bring these old PSP scene stables to newer devices. And as for a quick summary here, they do state that Desiptar del Cementerio allows you to unbrick any PSP, while the ARC custom firmware with CIPL allows you to use a fully and truly permanent custom firmware on any PSP. Yes, it is better than Infinity. And this is also the other thing too, these newer ones are more pushed with the ARC custom firmware, which is the newest one. It is the one that is still in development, still being developed to this day. So unlike something such as Pro ME or LME, which is just, they still work fine, but they are just older and more outdated custom firmwares. It even mentions here that the ARC custom firmware has matured over the last years and outshines the other popular PSP custom firmwares, the ME/LME custom firmware and Pro custom firmware, by providing more features, a brilliant NXMB method of configuring its CFW settings and plugins, better and faster ISO loader drivers, support for more optimized and also niche ISO formats such as ZSO, JSO, DAX, and a newer V2 variant of CSO, more robust safety measurements, and also offers the most variations of usage. So temporary, launchable via an XMB icon, perma-patched, new CIPL, entirely off the memory stick, etc. It even supports the PS Vita's PSP emulator and Adrenaline. For anybody who might be unfamiliar with Despertar del Cementerio, it is, as stated here, a legendary unbricking tool, which typically you'd have this on a memory stick that has been customized and set up properly, and it'll work with a Jig Kick or a Pandora's battery to boot into a menu like this, where you can go in, you can install an official firmware, a custom firmware, you can modify the NAND on here, like back it up, reflash it, check the hardware info, even boot custom firmware from your memory stick if you so choose to. The real big thing about this, because people might just say, oh, well, yeah, this is just working standard on a PSP. No, right here, you can have a fully bricked PSP, and as long as you can get it into service mode and boot it up into Despertar del Cementerio with a Magic Memory Stick, you can get this up and running. You can have this working on a fully bricked system and then restore that bricked system, which is really awesome to see. Now, for anybody who might already have an Infinity modified PSP, I'm sure that's totally fine. However, talking about the CIPL, why it is so good here is, first of all, the big difference is that, as he mentions here, this did not work on the new unhackable PSPs. However, now a custom IPL is working. Other permanent methods of installing a custom firmware, such as the old 6.20 permapatch or even Infinity version 2, are technically inferior to CIPL, as these permapatches are effectively just auto-launching the temporary variants of light custom firmwares, such as LME, ARC, or Pro, and makes them appear permanent. This means if you happen to mess around with a PSP's flash zero and end up corrupting important firmware files, you most likely cannot recover from this issue and end up with a bricked PSP. Custom IPL itself is much more powerful as it replaces the original IPL of the PSP's firmware and allows you to have a lower level access during its boot chain. This allows you to utilize various additional safety measurements, which in turn allow you to recover from a brick in most cases without requiring a Pandora or Baryon Sweeper kit. Additionally, it also allows you to install plugins and themes directly into the Flash Zero, something that traditionally had only been possible on PSP's 1000-2000 models running old CIPL custom firmwares, as messing with the Flash Zero PRX files and some RCO files was nearly always a certain brick if done on the newer non-CIPL PSPs. The good news is that the new CIPL has the same features that the old one has, but it now works on all PSP models. So there we go. We have some amazing releases here this month in regards to the PSP that are really awesome to see here overall. Now, this one, unfortunately, I don't have any show and tell on. However, this has been circulated a little bit with some hype in the PS2 scene here, and this is a release which is DKW DRV, which here is a unified single PS1 DRV replacement compatible with mostly all PS2 models. So this is going to be a way of playing PS1 games on a modified PS2 from a USB drive. Some people might be thinking that's already possible, and technically it is, but this one here is different, and we're going to get into why here. It states here on the GitHub repository that this is a replacement for the original PS1 DRV of PlayStation 2 consoles. The original driver was heavily limited in features, sometimes on purpose and sometimes not, making user experience a real hassle. DKW DRV aims at overcoming this issue and making a much better gaming experience, built from scratch by reversing both types of original drivers and merging them into one single unified driver. This project is not related in any way with the existing PS1-related PS2 homebrews out there. At the moment, the project can be considered beta, and many issues can come due to the big number of hardware and game differences. Users are welcome to submit issues or request features. With time, more details and documentation about PS1 operation and PS2 mode will be provided. And really, the big thing here again is playing your PS1 ISOs off of a USB drive. So it does have to be FAT32. There are some limitations since all bin tracks must be merged, all bin dumps must be 2352 sector sizes, games must be defragmented, augmented. No disk swapping implemented yet, but planned and doable. So just keep that in mind. And really, you'd be building it out like this. In your USB drive, you'd have a DKW DRV folder. You'd then have a bin folder, and inside of there, each game would have its own folder. And inside of that, you'd put your bin, your queue, and your cheats.txt if you have any cheats that you want to load in. Now, there are a few features here, and I do want to highlight this real quick before we kind of delve into them a little bit. Some people might be wondering, well, I can just put a PS1 game into my PS2. Well, this is USB loading. It's not going to be loading from a CD. Or some people might be wondering that I can already do this on OPL or something else using POPs. And POPs is the very limited PS1 software emulator that was released for the PS2, which then modders ended up taking, and they were able to reuse and kind of put some fixes on and such to get PS1 games to load up through an internal drive, through USB, what have you on there. This is nothing related to POPs. It's nothing related to that. To my understanding here, this is using the actual PS1 hardware. So this is kind of similar to having a PS1 optical drive emulator for a PlayStation 2. Now, for some of the features here, it does have USB game loading, but that is for Deckard consoles only. Almost the exact same emulation behavior as original drivers. This could help many people. There's an automatic PS1 video mode change. So another limitation of the original drivers was using one single mode, sometimes making the game appear too fast or too slow and off screen. PS1 V-Mode Neg was a good progress, but still limited. Now, the driver will auto-adjust to whatever video mode the game requests. Users can also force a mode on purpose. This solves many problems for users of Mechapone and Tony Hacks. Dithering can be force-enabled or disabled, so no need for game patches and cheats on here. Screen offsets are an option. PS1 config options can be tweaked and saved. Cheats can be applied to Deckard consoles only, so there's a cheat section we can look on this, but that would be for the cheats.txt file that I had highlighted earlier. Automatic libcrypt patching for libcrypt protected games by setting the final key to cop registers, so all magic words from gamedb.py. I've mentioned this a few times here, but Deckard, with Deckard only consoles being the ones that will really get the most fun out of this with the USB loading cheats, things like that. Do keep in mind there's essentially two models in regards to this here. There's the Deckard and PGIF, but it does seem like even if you're not one to load games off of USB, in terms of the usage here, because it does state that you want to have a PS1 disc inserted prior to running this software here, so even if you're just playing games off of disc on the PS2, you can have a much nicer experience, it seems, if you are booting them up through here as opposed to just the default way on the PlayStation 2. There's a few Deckard button combinations for Deckard consoles. So for example, you can adjust the screen offsets if you want to. You can toggle in-game cheats if you have any cheats set up there. And you also have different options for filtering, such as polygon MMAG filtering, polygon MMIN filtering, sprite MMAG filtering, and sprite MMIN filtering. I was hoping to see some combinations for swapping out game discs and such, although, like I said, right now, it does not seem to support multi-disc games, but that seems to be something that will be resolved here in the future, just as long as there's more development on here. And the last thing here would be cheats. That on Deckard consoles, you do have access to cheats on here. So you would set them up in a text file. It'd be like this, where you have commented lines here, which each of these comments would really just explain what the cheat does, and then you have the cheat itself. And it looks like here's a list of the supported cheat codes on here, and it's referencing the Duck Station naming. So it seems like really the type of cheat format that you'd use for PS1 games in Duck Station would be the same type of format you're going to use in your cheats.txt here. So there's going to be some uniformity on this. Either way, though, this is really awesome to see it finally be released. I know it's been in progress and worked on for, I think, a few years now at this point, and it has been teased a little bit, but now we do have an official release, so you can come over to the releases page, and it's really just the latest ELF file that you download, and then you launch it. However, you can launch ELF files on your PS2, whether it's through FreeMcBoot, OpenTuna, a mod chip, or really anything else, as long as you have access to be able to boot up Homebrew on a PS2, you can give this a try for a better PS1 experience. Now, there was some interesting news in regards to Pretendo, and this was important because for anybody who does not know, earlier this month, actually on April 8th, 2024, the online servers for the Wii U and 3DS multiplayer had shut down. So people were trying to get in their last purchases, their last gaming sessions, all of that. But Pretendo has been around for a while, and for anyone who does not know, this is pretty similar to, I guess the best way I can kind of, you know, compare it is the Insignia service, where Insignia is the original Xbox Live replacement service for the original Xbox, which is free and available for anybody to use. Pretendo is essentially the same equivalent of that, except for the Wii U and the 3DS. And typically, you would have to modify your system in order to use it. So it states here from this post that today marks the end of the Nintendo Network. As sad as this day is for many, it also comes with some positive developments. In this blog post, we'll go over some new developments and plans, including official game support and a new way to connect to Pretendo without homebrew. Now, going past the farewell message here, we're talking about SSSL, which they state, as a parting gift to you all, we are releasing our private SSL exploit for the Wii U, SSSL, found by our very own Shutterbug. This exploit allows users to connect to Pretendo Network from a stock Wii U, with no homebrew or custom firmware at all, only a DNS change. We've been holding onto this exploit for this day for quite some time, in case Nintendo decided to issue patches for it. Select services which use their own SSL libraries are unsupported. This includes several third-party titles like Watch Dogs and YouTube, as well as titles which run in an embedded browser like TV, the eShop, and the Miiverse applet. Miiverse functionality in games is still supported through SSSL. We hope this new method of connecting will be useful for those who have trouble installing homebrew, those who are worried about mods, and for users who may live in areas where local law may make it more difficult to install mods. For more information, see our updated setup guide. It is worth stating that SSSL is only available for Wii U systems running firmware 5.5.5 or higher, and it is not available for 3DS users. So for the 3DS, you're still going to have to modify your system. However, it is nice that we do have this available for stock Wii U players if you do not want to modify your Wii U at all. And it was also respectful, I would say here, that on purpose, they only released this after the network was taken down. Now, we're going to be covering this article from The Verge right here in regards to iOS itself. And they state here that Apple opens up the App Store to retro game emulators, which this happened earlier this month. And when the news dropped, it was actually pretty unbelievable. Like, people had to go into the terms of service and make sure that it was legitimate here. But they state here that game emulators have long been banned on the App Store, and they were one of the big reasons users in Europe might seek out third-party marketplaces. But they're stating here, and this is from Emma Roth, stating that Apple is loosening its App Store restrictions and opening the marketplace up to retro game emulators. In an update on Friday, Apple announced that game emulators can come to the App Store globally and offer downloadable games. Apple says those games must comply with all applicable laws, though, an indication it will ban apps that provide pirated titles, which again, certainly makes sense right there. The move should allow the retro console emulators already on Android, at least those that are left, to bring their apps to the iPhone. Game emulators have long been banned from iOS, leaving iPhone owners in search of workarounds via jailbreaking or other workarounds. They're one of the key reasons so far that iPhone owners in the European Union might check out third-party app stores now that they're allowed in the region. Apple's change today could head that off. Alongside the new rules on emulators, Apple also updated its rules around super apps such as WeChat. It now says that many games and many apps within these apps must use HTML5, clarifying that they can't be native apps and games. Now, overall, I think this is a great move. I think not only iOS owners can now actually enjoy this without having to modify or jailbreak their devices on here, but also this is a big push against, which was really needed on here. Unfortunately, as I covered in the last episode, due to the Yuzu lawsuit and then subsequently the Yuzu emulator as well as the Citra emulator being taken down since they are from the same team, there's unfortunately been a lot of fear and a lot of knee-jerk reactions where several developers have been unlisting, removing, taking down their tools, applications, emulators, and such on here, which has really disappointed many people. So I think it's a really big move when you're having a giant company like Apple explicitly changing their terms of service to now allow emulators in their storefront. Now, the last thing I want to cover here is something that I normally cover at the end of the episodes here, where I might include something that is interesting, cool, funny, somewhat related directly or indirectly in the world of modding. And this here is a device that was teased by Inside Gadgets here on Twitter, saying, introducing the GBA Bluetooth TX cart. Play on your Switch and other devices using a Game Boy Advance. Supports any device that works with the Zero 2. So that'd be the Raspberry Pi Zero 2 is what they're referencing. Register your interest on the shop. However, due to the complexity to make, it's a bit pricey. So right here, it's just a video that we can check out, which we can go ahead, blow this up here. And if we look right from the beginning, this is a custom made PCB here. It states Inside Gadgets on this. But going through, they end up taking this, plug it into their Game Boy Advance, Inside Gadgets Bluetooth GPA controller 1.0, Switch left, Windows X input right, Android B, Mac OS A, keyboard right trigger, and start connect to last device. So that's okay, that's a nice option right there. So he's going to press left on the D-pad, or start actually. And there we go. He was able to hit the left and right buttons. And check this out. On the Switch Lite in the background, you can now see that this Game Boy Advance is connected to the Switch Lite as a Nintendo Switch Pro controller. And going through here, they're able to control it just fine. So this is really awesome to see. I do look forward to more updates on this and seeing, you know, this get out into the wild there. But overall, it's really awesome being able to essentially Wii U it up here, you can say, where you're using another console as the gamepad to control your game itself on here. Anyways, that is about it for this episode of Mod Chat. I hope it was an enjoyable listening or watching or viewing experience. I hope you got to learn something and also be entertained from all the updates here. Now, typically at the end of these episodes, I like to pick a keyword or a key phrase. If you use that keyword or key phrase, I'll know that you've made it to the end of this episode. Typically, I end up picking something on my desk. So, you know, this is a tool here, but I've kind of just used it as a little bit of a fidget toy for a while here. This here is a Cool Runner Rev C, not a legitimate one. This one is a clone one right here. It's a glitch chip and one of the best glitch chips out there for use with the Xbox 360. I've installed a few of these. They are fun little things to install and cool looking boards to have on hand. So it's kind of nice to not only kind of like play around with it, but also show people as well too. Either way, with all that, how about bored? How about that? Are you bored easily? Or does it take you a while to get bored? Do you like to create printed circuit boards? What is your favorite board type? Let me know. Let's just use that. Let's use board. If you use the word board, and I guess any type of spelling will do there, as long as you use that word in your comment on the video upload, I'll know that you've made it to the end of this episode. Anyways, that is about it for this episode of Mod Chat. This is Mr. Mario, signing off. Thank you all for listening and watching, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, a like would absolutely be appreciated. And if you didn't like it, a dislike is fine as well, too. But again, as I always say, this is Mr. Mario, signing off for real this time. Later, everyone. And until next time.